You are about to listen to the question and answer section of a public forum sponsored by Wayne and Susquehanna County Rescue. The forum was held in the Forest City High School in Forest City, Pennsylvania on September 16, 2009. The topic was natural gas exploration and drinking water. You will hear questions from the audience that attended the forum. There were two speakers from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and one speaker from the Pennsylvania State Cooperative Extension. The speakers are Craig Lobbins, the DEP Northwest Regional Manager for the Oil and Gas Program, Jennifer Means, the DEP Regional Manager of the North Central Office for Oil and Gas Management located in Williamsport, and Brian Swistock, who is a Water Resource Extension Specialist working for Penn State Cooperative Extension.
But the components of these frac solutions, which is the big concern, many of them are unknown because it's proprietary information for each of these companies. So the question is, well, how do we test our water for something that we don't know is there? And I think you answered that question, but I just want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly, which is if we look at these things that you gave us as a sort of a test marker with TDS, pH, barium, and chloride, I assume those are things that occur in high concentrations, so if you see those, there's probably something else. Is that a...
Yeah. Basically, since those things are so high in weight, if there's going to be any problem, your water supply is going to see increases in those. And those are easy things to test for that most labs can do. And they're kind of like tracers or indicators that tell you there's something that might be going on. And if you see that, you can file a complaint and have them investigate it further. To try to test for all the fracking chemicals, well, the water lab is going to love you to death for that because you're going to have to write a big check to do that test. In fact, a lot of labs can't even do that testing. So that's why some of the research we're looking at is whether we can use things like total organic carbon, which is one test, kind of a broad test, does that give us a good indicator of these fracking fluids or not? Or are there other things we can look at that will trace that? But in the absence of that, a simple barium fluoride TDS test, kind of where we start, I think is a very good indicator of these problems. You're not likely to see an increase in fracking fluids without seeing those.
And my question for the two folks from the DEP, and either one or both of you can answer this, and I'd ask you to answer it as candidly as you possibly can. Based on the fact that, one, you're trying to staff up to handle this activity, and the fact that this activity is increasing at a rather significant rate, scale of 0 to 10, 0 being not confident, 10 very confident. How confident are you that the staffing that you presently have is going to adequately handle enforcement issues for all this stuff that's going on in northeastern PA? Now, before you answer, was everyone able to hear Brian's answer without having the microphone?
No.
Okay, so if you would, just when answering, just come on up to the mic and then...
Yeah, you probably can. That's
probably. Well, now it's bolted down. They're afraid we're going to steal it. So if people have questions, please come to this microphone and then please address your questions specifically to who you want to ask. And I'll ask, obviously, who you want.
Okay. I think it's a staffing question. I think right now it's a very good start. We essentially. I think everyone realizes what's going on across the state as far as the budget. We don't even have a budget signed yet and stuff, but this is the first phase. We added 37 positions, and our plan is to add more positions. So we just, so I think on a scale of 1 to 5, I think we're about at a 5, but I think everyone can see that there is going to be continual growth out in this area. So I think the state actually has plans on adding more staff, but we did a workload analysis, and that's part of our projections, and this was the first phase of it. So scale 1 to, I'd say 5. Play right in the middle.
No.
Okay. So just to clarify, so scale from 1 to 5.
Or 1 to 10, 1 to 10.
You're about right between the...
Yeah, I mean, Jennifer has a large area to cover on the eastern, I don't know how many, there's 40, probably 40 counties over there. But most of the activity is probably in about 10 counties. And, she has 5 WQSs and 4 inspectors is what I think what she's planning on having. But I think, next year, I would hope to see more staff added because we looked at this one slide I had last year. We had 400 Marcellus wells, and that was statewide, north and south, you know, statewide, north and south. This year we're at 1,200. Probably by the end of the year, you know, we're looking maybe 1,600, 1,700, I think. And those are permits issued, but a permits issue, they have 1 year to drill. If then if they don't drill, then they'll do a renewal if they're still interested. And that's usually what happens. They end up renewing those. So I actually anticipate Jennifer getting more staff. I will not. I think my region's pretty well stable. And what will happen if our activity kind of curtails a little bit, you know, we'll actually transfer some of that complement out the east side, I see. So I actually see the oil and gas program growing a little bit, or else it'll be a shift, you know, from the Pittsburgh office, Meadville office, to the Williamsport to have additional coverage out there. I actually envision her office going to permitting too. And right now we just kind of did it in a phase in 17. And that's just on the compliance end. If we actually did the permitting part, her office would have had to grow by another probably, I don't know, eight or so. And so it's too big. You know, so this is a very good step. You know, we needed to get boots on the ground, watch the activities and stuff. We could actually permit something, you know, across the state, because I mean it's all paperwork. And but I actually, you know, her office will end up going to permanent here probably in the next couple of years too.
This is a question for Brian that doesn't specifically deal with gas drilling, but it was a point that you brought up I thought was interesting. If you're not, which I would assume you wouldn't be, allowed to sell water from your property, how does that relate to spring water companies that are selling water?
If the municipal water suppliers and others get special permits that allow them to do that, and a homeowner can only really sell access to water, technically speaking. You don't own that water, but there are special permits like the communities have to sell water to their customers that do allow them to sell it.
And what recourse do residents have if they, I don't think this would apply to my place, it's up on the mountain, but people who live in neighborhoods where there's an awful lot of criminal activity like Chem Lawn and Sears Lawn and Green Thumb and all that stuff on everybody's lawn, that's got to get into a well someplace. I mean, creeks.
I wouldn't say it happens. It does happen occasionally. The thing to remember about, for example, Chem Lawn and a lot of that stuff gets bound up very quickly. So the real problem with that is if it's applied right around a water supply, again, within that very small area, it's much less likely that it's going to make it through all the soil and rock.
Like on a lakefront property or something, I would think.
Lakefronts are a bigger problem with a lot of applications of herbicides and fertilizers. Those are bigger problems. And we do a lot of talks for lake community associations about reducing that to try to cut down on plant algae growth in their lakes.
It's not illegal at this point.
No.
My question is for Jennifer. Before I came, I read this article in the New York Times. Did you see it? Is this on Sunday? Which kind of compared environmental protection agencies in the different states identifying facilities which were out of compliance, and whether any prosecution or whatever you call it took place. And I noticed that you said you were responsible for both of those things. But in this article, just for your information, Pennsylvania came out very poorly, indicating that they have 4,355 regulated facilities. 392 of them are out of compliance, and 20 of them had enforcement actions taken. So I just really wanted to know do you feel like you can enforce these things?
I guess it's kind of hard to address that a little bit because I'm not sure what type of facilities they're talking about there. I mean, I know our field staff go out to inspect well sites every day and, you know, regularly document violations at these well sites, and we regularly send what we call our notices of violations to these companies, and, you know, tell them what they need to do to correct the problem, and what comes after that is assessments of penalties and that sort of thing. So We're in the process of a number of those right now. We're, again, since our office just kind of started this spring, you know, it kind of takes a few months to get that going, but I think it's a routine part of what we do. So those
assessing
numbers.
Assessing penalties is a routine part.
Yeah, I mean, taking enforcement actions, assessing penalties, if necessary, issuing orders to companies. I'm talking, you know, generally, not just well sites, but to take corrective action on whatever they need to do. That's a routine part of what we do. So I'm not really sure that those numbers make sense.
Do you have anything you want to say there?
Yeah.
Just an example. Our office probably issues about $400,000 of civil penalties a year. When I say our office, oil and gas issues about $400,000 of civil penalties a year. And just in July, we issued a cease and desist order to a company because they were just trying to do too much too fast and to get too many violations. So we actually stopped their business for about 2 months period until they got everything all buttoned up again, everything under control, and then they were allowed to operate again. And actually, that company had assessed a $200,000 penalty for them. They're operating in McKean and Warren County. So we do take enforcement action. U.S. Energy. Yeah, that's no secret. U.S. Energy Corporation.
My question is a follow-on to the previous questioner about the New York Times article. On their website, you can look at the number of violations by state of the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. And I looked on the website for Pennsylvania, and it listed 9,408 violations of both those acts. They list the violations, the violators by name, starting with Allegheny Ludlam Corp. and 449 violations. It goes down from there. But what was interesting is that it shows the amount fined for these 408 violations, and the amount is zero for the entire state between 2004 and 2007. Do you have any explanation of this? And can you give us some confidence that your enforcement will be more aggressive than apparently the DEP is now doing with the Clean Air, or rather the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act?
I honestly, having not seen the article and knowing that, again, penalties are a routine part of our action, I don't really know where those numbers are coming from. So it's hard for me to address that, and it's not related to our specific industry. Do you have anything?
Yeah, that 9,400 is probably statewide for all the programs, not just dealing with oil and gas, I would assume.
The Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water Act.
Okay, so Safe Drinking Water, that's commercial facilities where, you know, if you're buying water, if you get a water bill, somebody's selling you water, that's under the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking. Clean streams violation, as far as people having discharges and stuff. And there's two different things. A lot of times our inspectors will go out and they'll document, when they do their inspection report, they'll document a violation. But some of the violation, maybe the silt fence is down a little bit, but there was not a discharge. So they note that the silt, you know, we call them BMPs, best management practices. You know, they didn't have the silt fence done properly. Maybe there wasn't enough rock and stuff around the collar pipe. There really was not an environmental harm done. But
the time says 60% of these are serious contamination issues.
Yeah, and it's hard to address something that I'm not really sure what they're, you know, what they're referencing, you know, what. But we do, and I can just speak for my program, oil and gas, and the number of penalties that we collect here. A typical penalty probably in a $2,000 range. $200,000, that's a significant. And I know easily year after year that we're up $400,000 or $500,000 is what we end up assessing companies and penalties. So we do take action. And some of these actions too, it's not a monetary thing on us as far as what I was telling you, we record require companies to plug a well. I mean, those aren't dollars that are coming into us, you know, that they, the company, it hurts their pocket, but we're, the state doesn't see that money. If we need to have them restore something, that costs them tens of thousands of dollars to do it, but the state does not collect a penalty on it. We might collect a, you know, a smaller amount on it, but it hurts the company a lot more than that. But the $9,400, I think someone is actually manipulating those figures. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that there's 94 violations. Maybe there was another 9,400 that they collect. They just, you know, looked at the ones that were not, you know, collected any penalties.
I do have a water question, but first I'd like to just make a suggestion. If you don't have enough employees, could you hold off the permits until you have enough employees?
Okay. One is that I didn't say we do not have enough employees. You need to kind of ask me to give my opinion on where we kind of rank as far as, you know, scale of 1 to 10, and we have 5. It's a new office being opened up. As far as not issuing a permit, I cannot deny a permit for not having enough staff. You know, there's only about 5 reasons I can deny a permit, and actually it's in that act. You can take a look at that, and those are the reasons I can deny a permit. As far as the governor would have to sign a moratorium for not issuing permits, and that's what happened up in New York. And but I do not have the authority to do something like that. Evan? No, I'm not.
Isn't there some way?
And we do have enough staff. I got, you know. Yeah, no. Let's be realistic about it, because these operators, they drill 24/7. Every hour of the day, 7 days a week, they're drilling, and I don't think anybody would expect an oil and gas inspector to stand on that rig at 24 hours a day. And if we did, just think how expensive that something like that would be. And there's probably the rig count in Pennsylvania right now is probably 75. So you had 75 rigs that are operating, and then plus our truck. You know, I just don't think that would be, and I don't know if that's what, you know, somewhat, you know, expectations are. But I think it should also be known. I think I was trying to make a point that drilling has been going on in Pennsylvania for 150 years, and I think and it's most of it's in the western part of the state, and I think if anybody goes to the western part of the state, you could. I don't think you see this mass devastation that maybe a few of you think might be going on out there. It's really not occurring. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Every well is hydrofracked. And by 99% of the wells are hydrofracked. And at the very every well is hydrofracked. At the very, sometimes you do have a real gusher comes in, and they'll produce that maybe for a few months, half a year, until, because it will come in naturally. But then after it comes in naturally, then the company will do the hydrofracking. The difference is the volume of water that's being used, you know, because there, you know, 10, maybe 50,000 gallons of water was used on these conventional wells, where we're talking a million. And a little bit of the difference is, you know, on these flowbacks, you heard that maybe your 30% return stuff. So if they put, you know, 3 million gallons down, they're only going to get a million back right away. But eventually they'll get a little more water back, but they'll never get everything back, because that shale is such a tight formation, it kind of holds it. But that's the big difference. And I was trying to make, you know, demonstrate that when these wells are constructed, they're designed to keep everything in the borehole. And yes, occasionally something, you know, if you drill 160,000 wells that we know of, you know, occasionally you're going to have an incident. And just like, you know, when airplanes are flying across the sky, they're built safe, occasionally you have an accident. So it's the same type of thing. I think we all heat our homes with natural gas. We put gasoline in our cars. It's a necessity, you know. And I think I think that the regulations are designed. And actually, Joyce mentioned the TAB committee, and it's actually a meeting tomorrow. And we're actually in the process of revising regulations, and we're doing some things to try to make it more protective for groundwater, and the big focus is gas migration.
One meeting I went to, it was suggested that instead of allowing the pits for the water that comes out to have tanks instead, because those liners leak. But my question really was, if our groundwater or if our aquifer is contaminated, I don't see how it would ever be cleaned up. And how are we going to get, how can we have clean water? Are these companies going to supply us with fresh water from somewhere else? And for how long?
If an operator contaminates your water supply, they are responsible to restore and replace your water supply. I just heard someone say 6 months, and that's no. The six months confusion is for presumptive liability. If they're presumed responsible, they're presumed guilty in that 6 months period if they did not do that pre-drill survey. Or if they did a pre-drill survey, then it's shown.
But my question is, how can they restore the water to its purity again if it's contaminated?
Yeah. And actually, to be honest with you, I'm not seeing that happen. And what's happening, and Brian mentioned, you have a short-term disturbance. And the reason you have a short-term disturbance is because that drill bit is actually in contact with that groundwater. So you rile it up, the dirt, you know, just like putting your, you have a dish with a little bit, say a little bit of sediment in the bottom, and you stir it up with a spoon, and then that sediment will just settle back out again. And that happens, and essentially that drill bit stirring up and it settles back out. Groundwater flows, it's a flowing system, it's just like a stream, but the difference is it crawls along at a snail's pace. So you have that disturbance, and if it does affect your water well, within weeks, days actually, that water clears up again because that slug, we call it a slug, is the water's moving. You have a slug of disturbance that moves past, and then it clears. And I know you're going to get into fracking fluids and.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, I don't care about the disturbance. I'm thinking about the contamination, real contamination.
Yeah. And I haven't seen it happen. So I mean, that's I think that you know we're worried about something that is a very rare occurrence. And yes, I said you know occasionally you do have something happen that you do have some you know this sodium and chloride you know elevated TDS, and that's the best indicator of this fracking stuff. And Brian had a slide up there, and it was logarithmic because it. He talks about the like salt water because it's up in the tens, hundreds of thousands, so you do see that brine solution. And the additives that they add into it, in my experience, it's limited, it's only been the last 6 years, but I have staff that's been there for 30 years, they have not seen it. And where they do see, and you mentioned about having a hole in the pit liner, occasionally you do have, because they have that flow back going back into it. If you have a shark in the bottom of a pit liner, a rocket pokes up through, you get some leakage, and then you end up seeing that brine water in your water supply. But again, it's a short-term disturbance because, that pit is temporary. You remove the source. After they're done, they pump that water out. They encapsulate that liner. So if you did have some leakage, it's a short-term activity. And these companies, what they do as far as restore replace, they drill new water wells or they put treatment systems in.
Hi, I'm not quite certain who to address this to, but I believe, could be wrong, I've been wrong quite often lately, that the gas companies have an option that they can remove the steel casing from our wells and just leave them with the cement casing. If in fact it's true, how long is the cement casing going to be stable in order to protect our water sources?
And removal being when the well is still productive, or removal after they've...
I'm not certain. I'm just understanding.
Okay. Yeah, when they decommission a well, when the well has expired, they're required to cement it. And what they're doing is cementing off that producing formation. So they do remove the steel at that time. They're removing that production pipe, and now they go back down in the hole on top of where the producing formation is, and they set a cement plug. And every producing formation, they're required to set a cement plug in that. But what they do, they clean out the well so they have a good cement job. So that's, you know, yeah, doing an active well as far as removing casing, that's the only reason they would do that if they're doing some type of repair. If like the well, you know, because some of these wells could be 50 years old, so sometimes they go back in and they'll remove casing, put good steel back in the well and back into production.
Is the concrete casing still in place? Because if in fact that is, that leaches caustic and toxic materials.
Yeah, it shouldn't leak toxic materials. I mean, the concrete, it sets up hard. I mean, the concrete,
it decomposes too. It
can weather, but you know.
And also, low-level radioactive waste is recycled into cement as part of the EPA's recycling program. How do you defend water in aquifers from that decomposing
concrete
that's releasing radioactive ions?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of radioactive ions that concrete would have in it. Maybe you're kind of mixing up with, they call it NORM, it's natural occurring radioactive material.
I'm talking about hazardous waste, radioactive waste from nuclear power plants and
question, please.
Yes. I recall it's your office that issues permits for these drillings.
That's correct.
And you've issued quite a few lately.
Yes, we have.
Okay. Now, Jennifer, is it Jennifer's job then? You get some sort of a statement from the drillers as to how, what their water, I forget the term you use, water plan is, I wrote it down, but I can't read my own writing.
A water management plan, that's...
Water management,
yeah.
What does that mean?
That's where they're going to get the water that they use in the drilling and fracking process.
Okay. And now what about disposal of that 20, 30, 40% of the water that comes back to the surface?
Yeah, they're required to dispose of that at a facility that can take it. It might be a sewage treatment plant, it might be a brine treatment plant, and they have to do all the... reporting requirements and monitoring that's required by our waste management program for residual waste.
Well, now, Craig, you've issued how many permits, I'd say, in the last 6 months?
This year, I think, I just looked at this number, 2,000, I'm going to say 2,000.
2,000
Well,
permits.
Probably a little more than that, actually.
And how many of them are drilling now? I just want this for my own information.
Yeah. I'd say probably half of those have probably been drilled this year. Half. Yeah, and I just want to follow up on that. A permit condition we put in for Marcellus wells that they have to have so when the operator gets a permit, they have to have this water management plan, they have to have this control disposal plan, and on that control disposal plan, they actually characterize the waste before they haul it off, and the way that they actually track it, there's a tracking process. And it is essentially three different people handle that waste. It's the operator, because he's generating it. The truck comes and picks it up. He documents it. And then the third person that has that same waste stream is the treatment facility. So we have record on where that waste is going. And that's something new that we've actually just implemented about a year ago.
Yeah, I could ask you a lot more questions on that, but time sure won't permit. But we're issuing permits. Do we have the disposal information at the same time? Because I'm concerned that we might be issuing permits not knowing where the wastewater is going. Now, Brian hasn't spoken much about the chemicals that are in this fracking mixture. How is that removed from the system? Are these treatment plants doing reverse osmosis or high pressure osmosis?
No. And the state realized that's where the bottleneck is, because there's going to be millions of gallons of new wastewater out there, and when we realize that TDS is a tough thing to treat, and really the way you treat for TDS is reverse osmosis that you mentioned. Or else you do crystallization. Crystallization, essentially you boil it, and what you have left, the vapors go off, and what you have left is a solid, and then that solid you dispose.
But as far as as far as you know, the treatment plants aren't doing that. Crystallization.
No,
I guess that's a long process.
Yeah, yes, and what the treatment plants are doing, they have a permit, Most permits are valid for 5 years, no longer than 5 years. And the state has a strategy in 2011 where they're changing the TDS numbers, and it's probably some of the other things too, but TDS is one. And we're going to have it. We have a strategy of it that they cannot exceed the 500, because the 500 is what we figure is a water quality standard. And the way they, what they're doing right now, these treatment facilities have a permit and they're allowed certain quality of water to come out of the pipe that cannot exceed that. So that is monitored on a monthly basis and actually on a weekly basis. So as long as they're not doing that exceed, and so long as they're meeting their current permit, then they're in compliance. But in 2011, the state is changing that, and they cannot change that overnight. You know, they are not in violation with their existing permit, but we're gonna tightly ratchet it down. We're gonna have more requirements in 2011. Wait until your turn, but we'll get to that.
You don't have, you said yourself, you're understaffed, you cannot have a person on site every day at every drilling site, correct?
That's correct.
How do we know they're sending this water to a treatment plant?
Because there's a good tracking process. We have a good tracking process in place now, because three different parties have, I guess the operator could be just dumping it on site and trying to get rid of it that way. But if he's not doing that, then he's gonna have to buddy up with whoever the trucker is. Now the trucker, you know, he's gonna, you know, maybe they got some little side deal going on, but we're tracking that. So everyone that touches that wastewater, you know, is a responsibility. Sure, there's some things that could slip through the cracks, but we, you know, and other than watching, having somebody that sits, you know, one of our employees sitting with the on site with that truck driver, you know, 24/7.
It's a public health issue, and I'm very concerned that Ryan would. I mean, we're spending all this time trying. How can we protect ourselves against the drills? And I realize you have to make policy.
Yeah.
How do we, why isn't it the other way around? We have food on the market or drugs. The drug companies, the food companies have to prove that it's safe. These drillers are not proving it's safe. So we're really dependent on you.
Yeah, and way you be your own advocate, and more eyes in the woods, you know, essentially, you all live in this area, and if you see some truck pulling, you know, pulling in the woods, or, I mean, that's the only way, you know, if you think there's some illegal disposal going.
A little more control than that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good evening. I live in Pike County, and I'd like to thank you for coming this evening. And I noticed from the map that there are two drill sites in Wayne County. Can you tell me, Jennifer, where they are and how they're disposing of their wastewater?
I think they're just permits issued and have they drilled? Do you know if they drilled? Have they started drilling in Wayne? Oh, one well they drilled. Go ahead.
Steve is one of our oil and gas inspectors. He works out of the Wilkes-Barre office.
They have drilled.
In Beach Lake?
Torrey. No, they've drilled one well up near, maybe it is Beach Lake. Just outside of Holmesdale?
Yes.
The Robeson well.
Torrey.
That's in Torrey.
Okay, that's I know it by the farm name, so I know it as the Robeson well. That well has been drilled, it has not been fracked. It's just been drilled and cemented, and actually it was drilled and then it was plugged. There's cement plugs in there, in that hole right now. At three different depths.
Well, what is their plan for disposing of the wastewater once that process starts?
They would have to get permits and...
There have been no permits issued for that?
I don't think they've even... They don't have any permits from the DRBC, if I know, for even withdrawals, and that's the big holdup.
In order to do the hydrofracking, they need to get approval from the DRBC, and they have not received that yet. So once they get that approval, then they would have a waste control plan, is what we call it, for essentially how they're how they're, what, where they're going to take the waste stream. So after they do that, their flow back, the fracking, they flow back, and then they tell us we're going to take it. But they're not allowed to do that until they get DRBC's approval, then our approval.
And is DRBC withholding approval because of the moratorium in New York State?
I cannot answer that for them.
No. All right. And also, the $200,000 fine that you mentioned, don't you think this is very low in an industry that's going to make millions and millions of dollars? When small communities and private homeowners, if they violate, you know, are hit with some very heavy fines, this doesn't seem to be. I mean, if I were making that much money, sometimes it would be better to pay the fine than go to the expense of complying with all of the regulations.
Right. Okay, first I got to mention that those were not Marcellus wells. And a $200,000 fine is a pretty significant fine. And actually, this company was out of business for 2 months. And that for that two, when I say out of business, they were not allowed to do any more drilling, fracking, building sites. And they had to go back in and for that 2 month period clean up their mess. And it didn't take them 2 months to clean it up, but it took that long for us to negotiate a deal on. And essentially what we're doing, we're managing the number of sites they're allowed to have operating at one time. So we're limiting, you know, like after you do 10, we'll come out and inspect your 10, and then we'll give you 10 more. And that's how we just crafted that. So we're helping them trying to manage their sites. And the first thing that one of the slides I showed you was the purpose of the act. And part of our charge is to, for the development of oil and gas. So we cannot just say companies, you can no longer drill in Pennsylvania. They have a right to. And so we try to strike a balance, but you know, what's fair to them and then what's fair to you. And the rest of those purposes too, you know, to protect your property rights, protect the environment, and to make it, you know, safe for the people that are operating those drill rigs and stuff. So we have to strike a balance, and that's, I just leave it at that.
Thank you.
Hi, I want to also thank you for coming, and I'm sorry I interrupted, but I get really frustrated with the hydro fracking issue because, and this really isn't my question, but there's a difference between hydrofracking and the kind of hydrofracking they're going to do in the Marcellus. Is that true?
I think the biggest difference is the volume of water. And probably the main additive that they're adding is a surfactant. And a lot of times you might have heard slick water. And what it is, it's a friction reducer because they're moving a lot of water and a lot of sand down that borehole extremely fast. And what they want to do is eliminate as much friction or drag as possible when they're doing that. So essentially, it's a soap, a surfactant. It's a soap. It's a soap. That's really what it is. And there are some other things to add in, and Brian mentioned that because they want to keep the formation clean, and clean by they don't want iron to build up. They don't want to have a bacteria down in there. So they add some of those other additives, and they're at small amounts, and most of them actually have a very short half-life or lifespan because when they take that water out now, they take it to a treatment plant. That treatment plant has to make sure that he's not putting some type of a bactericide or something in the stream because it's going to end up killing the aquatic life and fish and all that kind of stuff. So they have a chemistry where it has a very short lifespan. So those inhibitors are essentially gone. By the time it gets to the treatment plant, they're gone, you know, as far as bacteria and that kind of stuff. So and those are at small quantities. So the big difference is the amount of water that they're using.
But when it's said that there's a lot of experience with hydrofracking, it isn't. Is there not a lot of experience with this type that they're using in the Marcellus?
I'm not an expert in that field, but I think really the big thing is the volume of water. A lot of times, instead of using water, sometimes they use foam and these like non-conventional things that they can do a number of different things when they're fracking. They can use like liquid nitrogen, and essentially, you know, that's an additive that they use, or they can use as foam instead of the water. But as far as I know, these Marcellus wells are using water, so they.
they've been doing this hydrofracking for decades, and just, you know,
not the Marcellus.
Yes, the Marcellus
that they're using here in the Marcellus Shale. A new untested process.
Yes, it is. Yes, I guess because it's just the volume. And why I say yes, it's the volume of water, and plus it's a shale too. So we
don't have a lot of history about what the outcome.
Not with the Marcellus. No, that's correct.
Because that's really what we here are concerned about is the Marcellus hydrofracking, not the older type of hydrofracking.
Yeah. Another comparable formation that's in Texas is a Barnett Shale, and they have about 15 years of history there. And if you maybe do a little bit of research or take a look at that and see if any of those communities have experienced problems with the hydrofracking.
Have you done any research on that?
I have not.
I have done a lot, and I've had a lot of problems.
With the hydrofracking?
Yes.
And what kind?
In the Barnett. Water problems, earthquakes is something I've had problems with.
Yeah, I've read that the stuff on the earthquakes.
My question, I'm sorry to sidetrack because it really wasn't what I was asking, but we passed around a petition here to restore, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, to restore this process under the Safe Water Drinking Act. But it's my understanding, and I'm not really sure I'd like to clarify this, are private water wells and private sources of water covered under the Safe Water Drinking Act? It's been my understanding that only protects municipal bodies of water. So if it's reinstated, if this Halliburton loophole is closed, it's still not going to protect springs and wells and what most people in Pennsylvania get their water from. Am I correct?
Well, what's correct about it is that private water supplies are not regulated. So I don't know, you know, what's really proposed. I imagine they're not going to, and I don't think the state's going to start regulating private water supplies.
So then, even if we do reinstate, close the Halliburton loophole, which is a good thing, I'm not against that. How do we protect our water here in Pennsylvania if it's not regulated? Closing the Halliburton loophole, is that going to protect our water supply any greater than it is now in Pennsylvania?
Closing that loophole would put the gas operations, you know, liable to the Clean Air and Water Act. That's as simple as that.
Yes, but it doesn't protect private sources of water.
But it will put the industry under, you know, the scrutiny it deserves.
Oh, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I get my water from municipal water, so it would protect my water source. But most of Pennsylvanians get their water from wells and springs. So that's not necessarily going to protect them. Is that correct?
I think my understanding of it is if that petition is successful and they're able to close that loophole, no, it's not going to change the basic fundamental issue of which water supplies are regulated. But it will have some control over what gets put into that water supply. In other words, in this case, by the oil and gas companies. If they have to disclose what's in there and those chemicals are subject to some oversight, it would at least protect us on the end of what's going into it. You're talking about what gets regulated on the other end of it, whether it's designated as a municipal source or a private source. But our concern here, I think, is what effect will gas drilling have on our water supply? Well, the intersection point for that is knowing what's in that frac fluid and regulating what the companies
can. But you've just stood here and said that what's in there is soap.
Well, I didn't say that. That's one of the
things. I'm sorry, you didn't say that. But that's what we've been hearing, that we don't have to worry about this because it's soap. Right? Isn't that what you've been saying?
And surfactant, right, which is essentially like soap.
We shouldn't have to worry about, right?
I didn't hear you say that.
Yeah, I...
You said that...
Yeah.
Would you all like to sit down?
I'd just like to follow up. The wells are built to protect the water supply. I mean, that's the way it was designed. I was hoping I illustrated that with the number of how much steel and cement that goes into them. And the fracking fluid should never touch the groundwater table.
A question, and I don't expect you to answer it, but a friend sent me the New York Times article. I haven't read it yet. And it's a little bit unfair to try to ask you to answer something that you haven't seen, but it involves and concerns us all. So I'm going to read that New York Times article. Could you take that back to your management and ask them to answer that? Because if it's as negative as the gentleman just said it was, I think the DEP would want to answer that.
Yeah, I think so too.
So could you do that?
Sure.
I mean, it would be great to get some sort of formal response.
Yeah, let me know when that was published, and then
I'll send it to you.
Okay, thank you.
I have a couple specific questions. What are the minimum number of casings permitted in a well? Can you get by with just two, or do you have to have three?
Actually, right now, you could just get by with one. And that would be on a very shallow well. The minimum number is one.
I'm talking about Marcellus wells, though,
yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah, two. Because you'd have to have a water string conductor pipe. They all use conductor pipe, but you don't have to. And then they're required to put a water string in, and then you would be required to have a production string. So essentially, two.
Is there a minimum depth for each casing? Because I'm looking at your explanation of the dimming problem, and it looks like it wasn't deep enough.
Yeah. The surface casing, the water string, has to be at least 50 feet below the deepest known freshwater groundwater that's used in the area. So if somebody has a groundwater well 450 feet deep, they have to go at least 50 feet below that surface casing. Now, here's the other thing that kind of comes in as far as I showed you that BOP on there. They have to have enough casing and steel. They have to have enough steel and cement in the well to be able to anchor that down. So probably if they drilled something that was only 500 feet deep, that is not sufficient to anchor that type of a valve on, so they'd have to go deeper. So two might be a little, I might be a little bit misleading. That one well I showed you is a typical well, and I think it had five different pieces of pipe in it. So it's kind of, I don't want to mislead you on the two, but I guess theoretically could do two, but I think most everyone does many more than that.
How do you verify that the casing is in fact effective? Because it's all visual. You sink the casing in, you watch the cement come out, but we still have failures of casings in some manner.
Yeah, that's one of the duties of the oil and gas inspector. He notes what kind of casing that's being used in the well. They're required to report that on. They have a well record and completion report, type of casing, how much casing, what type of cement. That's all documented on the report too.
Are those reports available on the internet?
No.
On the DEP website, for example?
No, but they are available in our record center. So, in Williamsport office, they'd be housed there, for the counties. Like this, the counties that you're interested here, that'd be there or else in our office.
So you'd have to travel to Williamsport and ask for that report?
Or else you can write to our record center, and for a fee that they'll charge a fee to do the file review for you and essentially send you those records.
Okay. Follow-up question on the casing issue. I don't know the specifics of concrete, but if they're pulling the steel casings and they're leaving the concrete casing in contact with the brine solutions over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, does anybody expect to do any follow-up to see whether that in fact is going to fail? Because brines and concrete, from my limited knowledge, don't seem to do very well. It's a problem 30 years from now, but it is a problem.
Okay. I can't comment on that, actually. I don't know. I don't know the chemistry behind that as far as what kind of testing. And
are you part of that oil and gas? There's a group within the DEP that meets and talks about this.
That's a technical advisory board.
Yes.
I am not a member, but I attend the meetings. The board is a five board committee that's appointed by the secretary, or maybe even the secretary, and they
make recommendations. They review like the proposed regulations and technical requirements. They review them and make recommendations and comments. That's their charge.
And Ron Gillies sits on that?
No, he would be actually the board members are is coming from industry, consultants, citizens. I don't. There's essentially like five. You know, the five different areas. They are not DEP employees or third party members. And but Ron Gillies would attend the meetings just to hear, you know, for dialogue and give. And actually, just for example, the gas migration. We've been, you know, tell them that, you know, gas migration is one of the concerns, and we need to revise the regulations to make the wells more protective. And that's one of the most likely. That's going to be one of the changes in regulations, which I see that proposed rulemaking in December, right, when the regulations will be posted in a bulletin.
Okay. And one last question: can you shed any light on why the well spacing in Dimmick specifically, because that's the only area I'm knowledgeable of, is so close? When we initially were told they were going to drill wells, they were going to be putting one well per 600 acres or so. And the well spacing is much, much, much less than that. And so the potential for water contamination because of all the perforations is much higher. Why are they doing that? Does anybody know?
I think right now it's exploratory, and they're going to, you know, there's going to be a point where maybe the well spacing is feasible at 1,000 feet, but maybe it might be feasible at 500, and or possibly even closer. And I think once they, you know, put some of these wells in production to see if one well is having an effect on it, they're going to maximize production. So they're going to figure out what the spacing should be to maximize production. So I think at first, I think they probably have a wider spacing to secure leases, to get producing wells on those units and stuff, and then go back in and start filling in the gaps. But a little bit of a problem with that is mobilization and stuff, because if they're working in this unit, they probably want to get all their work done there before they go on to the next county or the next township. So they have to try to balance that too. But part of it, they probably want to secure leases, try to find out, you know, what production is like in Susquehanna, what it's like in Bradford, you know, down in, and then they can kind of direct their resources where they think, or their investments where they think it's going to be most profitable for them.
Okay, thanks a lot for making your presentations tonight. Appreciate it.
Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm from Dimmick Township in Susquehanna County. So I think Jennifer might be able to answer my first question. And you'd made a comment, or there have been comments made about how the residents can keep their eyes open, and if we have any concerns that you'd like to hear about it. And actually, my husband and I have been asked to send pictures to, actually it was Steve Watson, I think his name was. So, hi, that's you? Hi, I'm Kathy. You got my picture. My question is, I can see where this could get like way out of hand, because, you know, as now my husband, my family and I are out in the woods a lot. It's not even our own property that we were actually seeing some problems. And I'm wondering, number one, when you do present some information that you're concerned about, is there a time frame that can we expect to hear back? Like, hello, this is not a worry, or, you know, how do we know that it's been checked into?
The best way for us to, you're right, we could get calls and emails from all kinds of people, and it's a nightmare to keep track of. So the best thing you can do if you see something that you really think is, you know, a valid concern, something that looks like it's a problem, is to call our, I always say complaint coordinator, but I think their service representative is the best term. And Craig actually had the right name and phone number on his last slide, because Barbara Santonico out of Williamsport actually takes the complaints for this area as well when it relates to oil and gas. I don't know her number off the top of my head, but I can give you our general number, which you can ask for her. And if you call in an official complaint, it gets logged in, it gets assigned to the appropriate program, which, you know, would be oil and gas, and to the inspector for the area. And we have to respond to that in some way within 10 to 14 days.
That doesn't mean it will be resolved in that time. It doesn't even mean, you know, it doesn't always mean a site visit. And something like this, it would mean a site visit. But some things can be done with a phone call. It just depends on what it is. But we have to respond to that in some way within that time frame. And then it might be something that goes on for a long period of time if there's a long investigation. Usually, if a complaint does come in that way, I believe, once we resolve it or close out the complaint, send some sort of letter to the complainant, as long as you're willing to provide your name and phone and address and everything. So, and if you do have contact with the inspector, they may be in touch with you as well, depending on what the situation is. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. And then my other question then kind of goes a little bit further, and maybe I'd like to address you, because I saw on the board that you have sometimes frack water is put out on the roads. And actually, yeah, it was yours. Brian, right? I'm sorry, I'm looking at you all. I think that's what I saw. And I'm wondering, in limited situations, I think is what it said, or something similar. So if it's in limited situations, why would that be number one? Why limited?
Well, they wouldn't put frack or turn water on rivers. It is limited to, for example, production fluids or treated brines where they've removed a lot. So there are stipulations on what can be road applied, and they couldn't apply frack or turn water for something
okay.
like that.
So how can we be certain?
We do allow brine spreading, but none for Marcellus wells. And the reason for Marcellus wells is because Marcellus does not produce brine water. Everything that's in the Marcellus well they're getting back is the frack water.
Mm-hmm.
So we will not allow an approval for, and the reason they put it on roads is for dust suppression. They can actually do a winter application too for like de-icing. But the department has made a ruling that we will not allow Marcellus well, any water from a Marcellus well to be used on rivers. It has to go to a treatment facility.
Okay, so when we see some unmarked trucks that are spreading water, I mean, what should we assume? Because I'm familiar, I live right across from a PennDOT facility, so I see the brine being spread all the time, which is, of course, another concern about, you know, what we're doing to, you know, our ground and our groundwater, because we've got brine going there all the time. But what do we think when we see water being put on roads by unmarked cars? And I know that it's used for dust control, and my familiarity with that is that they do it where there are homes and they're trying to keep the dust down in residential areas. But when you see that roads that are going out to these sites have dust on it, and yes, I know that there's a lot of traffic, I can see it from my porch,
right.
But are we to just go ahead and assume that that's safe water?
Yeah, well, they're common practice to use fresh water for dust control.
Right.
Because it's, you know, especially, you know, you get a dry period and there's a lot of truck traffic, there's gonna be a lot of dust. Now, if the water, and you probably won't know this, if the water is salty or if you had a conductivity meter or something like that, if you really suspect them, somebody applying some brine water out on the site, and the brine water most likely in this area would be more of the frack return coming from a Marcellus well instead of a risking, you possibly might have a risking well in the area that they might be coming in, but I would contact the service representative if you can't take a sample, you know, if you can't take it, which I'm sure you don't have you might have conductivity or something, but alert us, because that's what we would do, because if it's out there public or whatever, you know, one of the WQS or an inspector would come out, grab a sample of that, you know, and we would send it off to lab, and then we would, you know, we'd use that to document, you know, that they were using this type of material. And then they would have to show to us that, well, if it was brine water, this brine water came from a something other than a Marcellus well.
Mm-hmm. Can you guys tell me if anybody's been out to the site that I sent you pictures from? Okay. All right,
You were notified before you sent me the pictures. I apologize if I get back.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Yeah, actually, I think my husband may have been the one that called you before I sent the pictures, so
yeah,
that's good.
It wasn't a frack.
Yeah, you know, and I got to tell you too, because this is how things get really. There should be some, I'm sure that there is some kind of education done with the workers on these sites, but the guy who came up out of the woods actually used, like my husband said, the F word. He said frack. And you have to be really careful. And I'm sure to him it was like, look, you know. I mean, he didn't even think that he could start maybe that kind of thing. You know, a little too late, actually. And that's, I think, what everybody's concern is. So much, so soon, before the area is really ready for it to come in. And also before those companies are educated enough that they can deal with the people around. It's, I mean, you know, there's a ton of things that doesn't even have to do with DEP, and that is how fast the trucks are traveling on a road. All of this, I've seen lots of accidents almost happen. I'd like to see the trooper, the state police's report on accidents. But that's, I think, what we're talking about is too much too soon. This is one of those.
I don't want anyone who's been standing in line to not be able to ask a question. So everyone that is, please ask a question. I ask you the, it's now 10 o'clock. We have some of our speakers who have to drive 2.5 hours to get home. So I'll ask everyone to just limit it to one question, your best one. Please ask, but let's just try to, I don't know, get out of here in 15 or 20 minutes if we could.
Recently, there was an incident in Wayne County where a chemical was coming off a truck. Trooper got ill, and several workers. The trooper was hospitalized, and three other workers were affected. I did some research on that chemical. I also found that there was no follow-up story on it. Who owns the truck? DEP handled this. Hazmat. The research I did, I followed up. Apparently, Procter & Gamble has a new drilling fluid, and that is one of the chemicals. So, what I would like to know is, since the gas and oil companies are saying that they don't need the EPA to cover clean water because the states are covering it, which you have informed us tonight, you really don't know what's in their frack fluid, how safe are we? And I've done studies with Dr. Theo Coburn, who says endocrine disruptors are in the frack fluid. Why aren't we discussing these things? Why aren't we told exactly? We don't have to know the minuties of the chemicals per se, but we are entitled to know as landowners what's going to affect our water. So I would like to know why you aren't doing anything about that.
Yeah, and I think we are doing something about that. And on that website, if you go, we have. Before they haul the frack fluid from the site, they have to characterize it. And there's a form 26R, if you go to the website, and you can see form 26R, and there's probably 100 different chemicals that they sample for on that sheet. So those are the things that they characterize before they can move that material off site. The incident in Wayne County, I'm not familiar with that. I don't know what was spilled.
I can send you all the data.
And if, when you say Hazmat cleaned it up and DEP was involved, that would be out of the Northeast office, their emergency response, and so that's a different program because it's not part of the oil and gas. It didn't happen on site. It happened when they're drilling. You know that because that incident is just like another truck going down the road, maybe a truck carrying, you know, I don't know, a truck carrying gasoline. Oil and gas would not be involved if that truck wrecked. Oil and gas would not be involved with that because doesn't have anything to do with the drilling permit. So I can't comment on the hazmat thing and what that chemical was.
The only other question that I have is about venting, and I would like to ask about venting. I understand that, but other people were allowed, so you can't really just limit the last few. I understand that, and I live far away too.
Ask your questions, just make it quick.
The venting problem. I just read an article in Nevada. Their venting reason is because there isn't pipeline. That's why they're allowing venting. And venting is a greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
Why aren't we putting the pipelines in place so we don't have so much venting going on?
Yeah. They're probably not venting because of the pipeline. They're probably venting to check in
the production of the well.
For 12 days?
Yes. And the oil and gas, and actually if you look in our statute and stuff, and actually regulations be better, they're allowed to vent. The only time they're not allowed to vent if they're creating a hazardous condition. So it's the law would have to be changed in order for my staff to do anything about venting. But that's just, and I can't, you know, I can only do what I have the authority to do, and that's what's in the statute. But I just want to make it clear that so you know that companies are allowed to vent wells as long as they're not creating a hazardous atmosphere. It doesn't talk about greenhouse gas. It talks about hazardous atmosphere.
Oh, I smelt it all the way down at my house and dumped it.
But, yeah, okay.
From Dimmitt. Thank you.
Just an information, because I forgot to do it when I was at the podium before. The Delaware River Basin Commission is having their meeting September 23rd at 10 a.m. at the Lake Wall and Pompack Environmental Center, and that's the next step as far as getting water out of the Delaware River, which is an important part of what we're talking about tonight as far as the water issue. If they can't get the water, then it may, it's just another step that we need to consider, and it's a very important step. So you can go to their site, the Delaware River Basin Commission, and if you can't make the meeting, you can make your public comment up until the meeting. My question very briefly, because I know you guys have to go, is that are there any plans to include the Department of Conservation as boots on the ground, since they are the people who live in the area and have much more long-term relationship with the people who live here, with the property owners, to help solve some of the issues that they're much more familiar with than people who live in very far away districts?
I am not aware of any plans, but the conservation districts getting involved in the oversight of our drilling projects.
I'd like to thank you for coming tonight. I've been to a lot of gas meetings, and this has been the most interesting, informative gas meeting. I even stayed awake for the whole meeting. I don't think I've done that in other gas meetings. So this has been a fabulous meeting, and the audience has asked such great questions. But you didn't get a chance to stand in line for your question, and I didn't think that was fair. So I stood in line for your question. So if you want to ask your question now, you can take your turn.
Ask.
You had a question about concrete, radioactive concrete. That's a very valid question. I've talked to other people about radioactive concrete. Smart idea.
Considering that the EPA allows low-level radioactive waste to be recycled into cement, how do you prevent the degradation of cement degrading and falling apart because of brine and just by age, as well as earth moving underneath, you know, there's tectonic plates and they move, so the concrete kind of moves and breaks, and the concrete's very brittle when it's exerted certain forces and tensions. How do you protect aquifers from radioactive waste that leaks and leaches out of that cement?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what EPA allows as far as radioactive material waste in concrete. That's actually the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, I think it's the first time for a lot of folks. The Sierra Club has a report on that, and you can look up in EPA, but Sierra Club will give you those little notes to find out more information.
Okay. So actually, it's the first time I've heard that.
Thank you to the woman.
No, I haven't heard that before, but maybe Brian, don't they traditionally use cement often to grout, water supply wells as well? So this has been going on for...
Yeah, and actually, as I said, Pennsylvania is one of the only two states that doesn't do that, unless you ask for it. So grouting is a bentonite material. It's not really cement, so it's a little bit different.
I wasn't sure, but I thought I would... Yeah.
Question I had was on the... when they're abandoning the well and pulling out the casing, would they have to leave the water stream casing, or can they take that one too, the steel?
I think they're taking out the production. I'm gonna say no, and a little bit of a caveat because I'm not 100% sure. I think what they're doing is taking out the production pipe, and so that's the inner string. So the water string, I'm
99.9% sure the water strainer always stays in place.
Well, I hope it would.
Yeah, yeah, so I, yeah, I'm pretty sure that they do.
They're required to she's talking about they'll take out the production string of it when they're acting on the gas. And then they'll leave that water string in there, grout that to surface. And they're required to either leave it 4 feet above ground so you know where it was, and they put a melt tag on it that it was abandoned and document that, or they're allowed to cut it off 36 inches in that area.
Below cloud line.
Below cloud line.
Right.
And then the same thing.
I'm confident that he leave the water protection string in, but I just a little bit of doubt there. That's
okay. That was my question.
I guess I could summarize my question is about the constituents of frack water. Do you know what they are? Are the gas industry required to report what the various chemicals could be, and where do we find that list? Can we get that for specific sites? And how do you test it and verify that what they say is there is actually there?
I don't know if I can answer all of that, but the first part, there's a little bit of a misconception here. Since last August, when we started looking at these Marcellus wells, we were requiring the companies to provide us with all of the MSDS material safety data sheets for the frack chemicals. So we've got volumes of those in our files. And if you want to do a file review, you can come in. Most of them are with the PPC plan. So we have many of those in our files, and you can look at them. There's also a list on our website that basically summarizes what the main constituents of the frack fluid are, and that is available on the oil and gas website. I know I've pulled it off from there before anyway. So I guess, you know, Craig has been involved in the drilling and fracking a lot longer than I have, but my personal perspective on this, from what I know about it just in the short time I've been involved, is as Brian pointed out in his slide with the pie chart, the amount of chemical that's in that water is a very small percent. And it's going down, I mean, basically a mile or so underground where this is happening, and your freshwater aquifer that we're all drinking out of is might be in the first couple hundred feet if you're, you know, on a typical private well. So this is just my personal perspective. The fracking that's going on a mile underground with that small percentage of chemical in that water would not be as much of a concern for me. I think there is actually, I mean, we have situations where we've got people complaining about their water being possibly impacted by drilling activity, and that's when, you know, some of the constituents that Brian mentioned, and they show up, and we go out and investigate those because of that contact of the drill bit with the aquifer, and that does happen on occasion. I'm also concerned, as the person who deals with this stuff regularly, that, you know, there are spills of things like that that are out on site. And generally they are cleaned up and it's not getting down to the groundwater level. But I'm more concerned about those types of activities than I am about the actual fracking with that small percentage of chemical a mile underground impacting my water. That would just be my perspective on it, maybe to think about that a little. But if you do want to see what those chemicals are, we do have lists of them available.
So you do track individual gas fracks so that a chemical that's found can be traced back to the actual?
No, we don't do that. I mean, we don't, you mean as far as going and testing for it? Or, we don't go and test for it, but we have the information of what they are using in the fracking in case, you know, there was a spill or something and we wanted to know what that chemical was and what its properties were. We can get that usually from the PPC plan.
And that's the same down there and everywhere as it is when it comes back, that 20%, 80%, whatever. And that water they take away, that's the toxic water.
That part they're supposed to be sampling before they take it to the facility or the facility that accepts it so that they know how to treat it. So it might change. You know, that's not necessarily the same coming out as what goes down. There could be a difference.
So they're required to tell where they're sending it, what it is.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And I think we have one last question, Wayne.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to thank Wayne Susquehanna Rescues for sponsoring this forum tonight, for all of you people for coming out and presenting. And I also wanted to thank Craig and Jennifer for meeting with my agency, the National Park Service, on September 2nd and answering some of our questions about your permit review process. The question I have, maybe this would be for Craig. When they set off these plasma charges to fracture the shale, do they always do that on a horizontal plane, or do they do it 360 degrees around the well bore? And do those fractures always follow the path of least resistance through the shale formation, or do they ever migrate vertically through different strata?
Yeah. Not 100% sure what they're doing with the Marcellus. I've seen it on other conventional wells, as far as like Medina or Riscany. And it's done in a helix pattern. So essentially it's a spiral that goes up along this. It's a shock tube. And the shock tube is whatever the thickness of the formation is. If it's 50 feet thick, then they'll have these shocks that go up. It's just like, if you're wrapping a cord around a flagpole, you go up kind of in a circle. So it's getting in every direction, and it's slowly climbing up. On the Marcellus, I would think they're going the same thing, because instead of being vertical, now it's horizontal, and they're going. Now these plasma shocks, they actually don't penetrate the rock formation very far. The purpose of it is to burn a hole through the steel casing, through the cement, and kind of like put a little dent or just a little, essentially the purpose is to burn a hole through the steel casing cement. And it probably does, you know, it puts a little pilot hole or something out there. So when they do start to frack, now the fluid is going to go, you know, the frack fluid is going to go as a direction is going to travel out in that.
Okay, I should have asked that question a little bit better. Yeah, I understand it's the high pressure water that creates the fractures of the rock.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of a all directions of
all the directions. Water. Yeah, and they want to keep it. They purposely want to keep it just in the Marcellus. They don't want to crack out into another formation and stuff, because they could be losing product out there. I mean, they're wasting material as far as sand and water and stuff. So it's pretty remarkable what they actually do. They talked about the seismic survey. You had the thumper truck, or else you do it set off explosives where you're mapping the geology underneath the ground. They actually do the same thing on these frack jobs, because they want to know where that frack is going, so they call it microseismic. They actually put geophones down in some boreholes, and they actually listen to where that frack is going, and they can map out three-dimensional, if it's egg-shaped or more of a rectangular box, so they know where the frack is going. So they'll do that for a few wells, and they have a pretty good idea that, you know, we need 4,500 pounds of pressure, a million gallons of water, and I don't know, 100 tons of sand, you know, so they get it down to a science, so they know exactly where that frack is going. And then they can actually kind of like draw a picture around that. Essentially, you got that borehole, they draw the picture around, and that kind of guides it to where should we put the next well? Should it be at that 1,000-foot spacing, or maybe we can get away with 700-foot to maximize production? Mm-hmm. So they keep it in the Marcellus.
Okay, thanks. That's a concern I've heard from a lot of people, whether or not the fractures extend vertically and possibly up into water zones or something.
Yeah. And keep in mind, that Marcellus is 6,000 feet deep. Your water well is up maybe 400 feet deep, so you have a mile between where they're fracking and actually the water. That's not going to be, if there's going to be any connection to that well, it's not going to be from the fracking way down hole. It's going to be somewhere else up the borehole, or maybe on the surface when they're actually doing the flow back into the pit, or doing the flow back into the tanks, you know, or maybe somebody's not taking the frack flow back where they're supposed to be taking it. That's my opinion. Most likely it's not gonna be coming from that deep frack. It's gonna be coming somewhere up the hole or else something on the surface.
Thanks.
I'd just like to formally thank all our speakers and everyone for your patience, and thanks for coming out.